food. It's a basic human need. Food. It lies on the same hierarchical need level as shelter and clothing, and more fundamental than love, safety, and security. Join us on the next Mind's Eye radio show for Sustenance, or Food for Thought. We'll take a close look at the effects of food, from malabsorption disease to the breaking of ethnic breads, and from running a restaurant to fasting. So tune in to Mind's Eye Radio for Sustenance, or Food for Thought. That's Mind's Eye Radio. It's radio within reach.
Food. The word conjures up images as diverse as any in human experience. Food can be sustenance for our bodies, our minds, our spirits. Food. It's the subject that begs us to partake. Welcome to Sustenance, or Food for Thought, on Mind's Eye Radio, the most creative hour on the air. I'm your host, Greg Willard. In the next hour, we'll serve up a banquet table of delicious delicacies, elegant edibles, and tasty tidbits. We'll visit a summer of ice cream and night rides in New York City, check in on one kitchen where a mother's skills run into pursuits other than cuisine, eavesdrop on a power lunch that takes some unexpected turns, and a look at fasting and starvation. All that and much more. So join us in a repast of fun and food. The table's set, the wine is poured, and we're about to dig in. Bon appetit. For a father out of work, the summer of 1959 promised another season of scrimping and saving with nothing but cornflakes and water for his son's breakfast. But when a job at a Mr. Softy ice cream factory opened up, things changed dramatically, as we'll see in writer Ken Haynes' story, Wavin' in the Cupboards.
When I was 10, I was always hungry, and in the habit of shuffling food around in the cupboards and refrigerator to see what I wanted to eat. I never gave much thought to food, clothing, or a comfortable bed, but, for reasons that my parents never talked about, the early summer of 1959 was different. My father Thaddeus spent a lot of time sulking about the apartment and chain-smoking Camels in the evenings when he returned from his job pushing racks of clothing in New York City's garment district. My mother Eloise devoted hours each day sitting at the kitchen table with her head propped up by her right hand. One day I used the chair to climb up onto the kitchen counter. I waved my hands over the top shelves of the kitchen cabinets, hoping to come across some item of food, a can of sardines, a forgotten cracker, or a raisin or two, anything at all. I opened and closed the refrigerator, then opened it again as though some previously unnoticed item of food would appear. It never did. I wondered what it would be like to be really hungry all the time. I didn't even like thinking about it, and trusted that the empty cupboards problem would pass as quickly as a cold. My mother's eyes were downcast, and tears hung precariously on her lower eyelids as she poured water on my cornflakes for the second day in a row. I picked up my spoon, then just stared at the strange concoction in the bowl. I felt obligated to try at least one mouthful, but I couldn't do it. There was a frantic knocking at the door. "Who is it?" Thaddeus yelled. "It's Hector," said the voice on the other side of the heavy steel door. "I gotta talk to you. I got some good news, I think." Thaddeus unlocked the door, and Hector took a giant step inside. "Hey, Thad, I went to Queens last night to check out that job cleaning out Mr. Softy ice cream trucks. The pay's pretty good, and there's no one to hassle you. You just clean the trucks, fill out a time slip, drop it in a box, and go home. That's it. And you can take home all the ice cream and stuff you want." "Do you know if they need some extra help?" Thaddeus asked. "That's why I'm telling you this. They asked me if I knew any good workers, and I told them that my best buddy Thaddeus Jones is the hardest working man I've ever known. So why don't you come out to the job with me tonight? They'll probably hire you on the spot." Thaddeus paced back and forth in the small living room. The apartment seemed to shrink when he allowed himself to think the kinds of larger thoughts that black men were discouraged from thinking, thoughts of saving money and buying his way out of the housing projects, thoughts of finding a job that paid him well for doing the work that he had been trained to do, despite the fact that the dental appliance industry was not exactly clamoring for black technicians in 1959. Thoughts of being simply permitted to be a man and a human without fighting to reestablish that simple reality at every turn, 7 days a week. Thaddeus spun around and looked at Hector as though it was the first time he had seen him that day and said, "How about if I follow you out there?" "Any way you want to do it is fine with me. I'll meet you at 10th Street and Avenue D at 10:30 tonight." Thaddeus took the job and came home the next morning looking like a new man. The tired look was gone, and he prepared for his day job with such energy and enthusiasm that you would have guessed that he had just had 10 hours of sleep. And in addition to the extra money he would be bringing home, he was laden with bounty, containers filled with melted vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry ice cream, buckets of pecans swimming in syrup, pails of cherries in syrup, Italian ices, chocolate sprinkles, and even shredded coconut. The lean times were over. I went to my father's Mr. Softy job with him from time to time, whenever I was asked. It was summertime. School was out. We hit the road late at night and left the cares of the city behind. We cruised down open highways, nestled in the lush seats of the 1956 Chrysler Windsor with push-button transmission and overdrive. Just me, my father, the sweet summer breeze blowing in our faces, and Symphony Sid on the radio. The majestic blackness was sprinkled with the sonorous tones of Nina Simone and super smooth Paul Desmond notes drifting through his alto sax, then dissolving in the night air. My father looked like king of the world on those nights, leaning back, looking so cool and handsome, with his left arm hanging out the window. He would punch the Chrysler into overdrive, and we would disappear deeper into the night. This is Ken Haynes for Mind's Eye Radio.
It seems that Mind's Eye contributor Sue Renard can't escape those TV chefs preparing everything from sushi to short ribs. Let's listen in as she surfs the channels in search of that special recipe.
"I'm Julia Child. Welcome to my house. What fun we're going to have baking all kinds of incredible cakes, pies, and breads right here in my own kitchen.
Welcome back to Cooking Live. Tonight we're celebrating the special relationship between mothers and daughters, and I'm here with Frida and Karen Kaplan of Frida's Inc. Our menu tonight is chili roasted edamame, corn jicama and pineapple salsa, grilled tuna and starfruit salad, grilled beef with horned melon sauce, tamarillo ratatouille, and passion fruit and mango sorbet. And we're on to our beef dish.
That was a mouthful of a menu.
Oh.
Okay, I'm so glad you called because this is a really common problem. You know, a lot of people have written into Food 911 with the same situation. You know, how do you feed a big group of people on a small budget and also offer them like a creative menu? So what we're going to do today is we're going to give you two dishes. We're going to give you shepherd's pie, and we're also going to give you turkey tetrazzini.
Great.
All right, so let's start off with the shepherd's pie.
Now we're going to take the prosciutto, and we're just going to flap it on like so. Now, when you buy prosciutto, you don't need to buy the whole thing unless you had a beautiful slicer at the house, which, in fact, you probably don't.
Hey, welcome back to East Meets West. Okay, Rocco, what's our menu? What's the first course going to be?
Well, the first thing we're going to do is make a bouillon of black truffles, artichokes, and those great matsutakis.
Beautiful. And then we're going to do a cod that is going to be shingled or scaled with truffles with a bell pepper herb confit.
That sounds good.
And then dessert, you're going to make a rice pudding?
Looks like a rice pudding, yeah.
Yeah, with
like
what flavors?
We've got five spice, ginger, okay, and a little bit of vanilla.
And then we're going to do a little brulee on top, which is going to be golden plum.
Buttermilk, referred to the watery, whey-like liquid left over from butter churning. Really wasn't good for much of anything. But today's buttermilk actually has more in common with sour cream or yogurt than its ancestor over here. See, low-fat or skim milk is inoculated with a bacterial culture. Now, these little beasties eat some of the lactose and turn it into tangy lactic acid, right? Now, when the acid reaches a particular level, the milk is heated, the bugs are thus dispatched, and that leaves buttermilk. Now, Bakers love this stuff, not only because of its trademark twang, but because a cup will neutralize a quarter teaspoon of baking soda, thus providing sufficient CO2 to lift one cup of flour. Okay, any questions?
Who cuts your hair?
So I've got a little mango, got a few blackberries, got a few raspberries. Then what we're going to do is you take another layer. Press it down. Really press it down. Press it down. Really press it down. More for Angelico. Yeah. A little more almond cream. If you want to do whipped cream, you can do whipped cream. You do a little ba-bam. Just a little ba-bam like that.
Bon appétit.
And happy cooking.
That was fun, Jack.
It was great.
The taste buds of children are likely to be tuned to a different frequency than those of adults. That's especially true when the adult happens to be Pierre Pomfrey, the creation of writer Dick Radke, and a group of second graders.
Bonjour, mesdames and messieurs, and welcome to another episode of Fufu Foods, the show that probes the culinary preferences of les enfants américains. I am your host, Pierre Pomfrit, and today we shall discover the culinary secrets of Miss Wessel's second grade class in the province of Mount Horeb, Wisconsin. We are here to ask these gourmets of tomorrow about their favorite cuisine d'arte. Les hors d'oeuvres? Les potages? Les pâtés? Which do you prefer?
Pizza.
Macaroni.
Tacos.
Macaroni.
Tacos.
Macaroni.
Ah, bon, bon. We see that this group has wide-ranging tastes and their palates are finely tuned instruments. Tell me about some of your most memorable gastronomical experiences, s'il vous plaît.
When I was at my house one time, we were eating spaghetti with chopsticks, and I got it all over my clothes.
When we were eating sloppy joes at my house, I got all over my head.
Once I ate Jell-O with my family, and I spotted the whole Jell-O in the bowl on my face.
Mais oui. As the budding gourmands, I am sure you have dined at America's most prestigious restaurants. Can you recount an incident that rises above all others in your vast experience?
The food was disgusting because I didn't even like it. I didn't even order. When we were at a restaurant, my sister spilled her food all over herself. She took a napkin and started wiping herself off.
One time I was going to the bathroom and then I ran into a waitress and then water spilled all over my head.
One time, my dad was rocking in his chair, and he rocked into a waitress and soup fell over his head.
I know the listeners are most interested in the sharing of culinary secrets, and our second graders have agreed to reveal their most prized recipes. So those of you out there in Radioland, get paper and pencil and be ready to escape some of the most exotic recipes in all the world.
I cook macaroni and cheese.
Well, you gotta boil the water and then you let it boil and then you put in the noodles and you wait a little bit and then I just take out a noodle and I try it and then I put it in like a drainer and then I take it out and put it back in the pan. I put butter in there and then I put the milk, a little bit of milk in there and then I put the cheese and I mix it up and then I eat it.
Jell-O. You have this powder. You dump 2 cups of water in a hot pan, and once you did that, you heat the water up until it boils. Then you put the powder in, you mix it up, and you put the mixture in the bowl, and then you wait for a couple minutes or hours, and then you have your Jell-O.
Soup. You take a can opener and open your can with a can opener and then you put in the microwave. You put it in a bowl first, and then you put in the microwave and let it heat for a few minutes, and then you eat it.
Carrot pizza. Put some sauce on English muffins, and then you put some cheese and pepperonis, and then you stick a carrot in the middle, and then you bake it.
This is something that I made up. I called it butter bread. First, you take some bread, and then you put some butter on it, and then you put on some cinnamon sugar, and then you put it in the microwave for 10, and then when it beeps, you take it out, and then you eat it.
No quiche Lorraine? No cassoulet de bœuf? No tartes au fromage? Ah, we are a long way from Paris. But nevertheless, merci beaucoup, gourmands of Miss Wessel's second grade class. We have learned a great deal today about the art of food, and our tables will be the groaning boards of pleasure in the days and weeks to come. For Fufu Foods, this is Pierre Pomfritz, signing off with a hearty bon appetit.
You're listening to Sustenance, or Food for Thought, on Mind's Eye Radio. Coming up, we'll hear about a mom who doesn't quite live up to being a great cook, get a postcard from the kitchen, and hear about food malabsorption. Stay with us.
Greg Johnson, Bon Appetit Cafe on Willie Street in Madison. I'm the chef owner. I've always had an affinity for cooking. I'm an artist, you know, I'm a painter, and I don't see any difference between the creative aspects of cooking and the creative aspects of painting or any kind of artwork. It's an art form. And I've had quite a number of cooks go through here. We've had 45, 50 employees, if you can believe that. I mean, I worked for the last, I got a vacation like about 3 weeks ago. I came back, I took a 2-week vacation. That's the first vacation I've had, first day off I've had in 2 years. So I was getting burnt out. I mean, if I had to keep doing that constantly, you know, I think I couldn't take it, you know, if I couldn't get some time off, you know, like a day. I mean, right now I'm on Easy Street. I've got these two guys, and the only thing I do is come in and make suggestions about specials and talk about specials and what we're going to do that's different from what the regular menu is. And both of them know the regular menu, so I can leave them. I went out last night. I mean, I'm actually getting nights off, which for me is a luxury. You know, it's what you need, though. I think I know the woman that used to run Taqueria Gila Monster. I was talking to her because they had a successful business, and they just quit. And I couldn't figure out why she did that. And she said it was just that grind. You come in every day, every day, every day. You know, 7 days a week. You're responsible for this thing. You know. There's a lot of restaurants here, which means there's a lot of, you're competing for the same little dollar. If you're lucky, you get your little niche. My personal opinion, I think you should try and keep it simple when you first start out, until your profitability is there. We've been here 4 years, and we've been profitable every year, which is kind of nice, you know, we're lucky that way. I think a lot of people think, oh yeah, a restaurant, you know, it's an easy gig. Just get somebody to make food and you make a lot of money, but that's not the way it is. You have to, I think the first year that we did it, we found out, oh, guess what, there's some nights you're not going to make anything, you know, nobody's going to come in. What do? You have to learn how to balance what you buy with what you're selling, you know. There's all kinds of little tricks that you learn. You have to be smart about it. And I also think that you have to love what you're doing, because if you don't really love to making food and you don't love doing it, those hard times are really hard to take. There's some businesses like that where you got to love what you're doing, because the money's not going to come falling in. Sometimes you make a lot of money and you feel pretty good, but there are lean times too. And if you don't love what you're doing, if you don't get any satisfaction out of it, it's really, you're going to quit. There have been times, the first week of January, nobody goes out. So why are we open? Why are we beating our heads against the wall? It would make more sense not to have anybody here, not pay staff, not be buying product, and just close and take a vacation. So you figure that out after the first year when nobody came in and we were like in a hole. Okay. And then there are times when, like when we, Veronica and I have taken, when we try to really up the pay off a lot of stuff and get ourselves really solvent, that just the two of us work for like 6 months. And I worked in the kitchen, she worked up front, we didn't have any staff. We let everybody go for a while. I mean, that's hard work. So you got to be willing to do that. You got to be willing to sacrifice.
Food may be the staff of life for some, but for others, food presents a constant daily challenge. In Gay Davidson-Zilski's cupboard, for example, any number of items are notable for their absence.
My ailments are never romantic. I don't get the vapors, which allow ladies to swoon gracefully onto conveniently placed couches. I get only ugly-sounding, nasty diseases that I cannot discuss in polite company. Chronic stuff that tires even my most loyal friends after the fourth complaint, and makes them wish I would get a cat or a bird, even a sick cat or bird being more interesting to listen to than my litany of icky symptoms. But food, as a topic, gives me finally the right, nay, the responsibility, to talk about all the things I can't ingest. Here are just a few in alphabetical order. Barley, beer, bread, biscuits, cake, cookies, crullers, crackers, crust, donuts, fluffernutter sandwiches, flour, gluten, gravy, hot dishes, icing, licorice, who cares? Macaroni, noodles, oats, pastry, and puddings, and pasta and pizza, quinoa, whatever that is, rigatoni, stuffing, I prefer the word dressing anyhow, but I can't have that either, sauces, spelt, tetrazzini, anything ending in the suffix ini is suspect, vino, windmill cookies, and of course the great granddaddy of all gluten-bearing foods, wheat, or ziti, for which, see ini. Here's a list of things I can eat. Rice and vegetables and corn flour and Vicks cough drops. I can drink Korbel brandy at my peril and a kind of vodka imported from East Germany that would take the tar off your driveway. Having me over to dinner is like inviting a whole pack of picky child royals. I now attend all-you-can't-eat buffets. It's estimated that if I were in a room with 50 other people, I would have at least one fellow sufferer who would also be hanging around the dessert tray looking depressed. Before the whole evening was over, one of the two of us would have inadvertently hoovered up the whole tray of crackers and would be dashing to the loo, if you catch my drift. My disease's technical name is non-tropical celiac sprue, or malabsorption disease. It is much more prevalent in individuals of certain ethnic blood types, the Irish, that's me, both sides, some Scandinavians, and Belgians, I think. It's hard to diagnose. I didn't develop clear-cut symptoms until I was 40 and had a newborn baby. Because its main symptom, diarrhea, sorry about that, can mean about 50 things are wrong with you. For example, I was told for several months by my doctor that I was a nervous young mother and that I would be fine. I told him, my ex-doctor, that I was neither young nor nervous, thank you so much, but rather happy as a clam with my most excellent new baby. I was sick. I insisted to the point that he granted me the favor of an endoscopy with a biopsy, not something one seeks out lightly, but the only truly diagnostic tool right now, which showed the telltale clubbed protrusions in my lower intestine. Once these little hair-like thingies, excuse the technical language, get bent over, they can't take in much nutriment at all. Most people lose gallons of weight. I was nursing a baby and still had a paunch, so didn't get this one possible positive side effect, of course. In case you haven't had enough, I offer this public service announcement. If you get sick after you ingest bread or pastry or anything with wheat or other grains in it, go to the doc and ask about celiac disease or sprue. Say the words. Ask for the test. Don't mess around with diagnosing yourself by staying away from these gluten-bearing foods. If you do, the celia will heal and you won't be diagnosed. But the next time you hit some grains or derivatives of this stuff, and it is hidden everywhere, even in candy and soft drinks, you will be immediately sick again. The good news is you can heal very well by abstaining. The bad news is that you are much more prone to certain cancers if you cheat, and that you are stuck with it for life. Not all people allergic to gluten get the full Monty that I have. Some react only to wheat, as if that's not exclusionary enough by itself. So, what does that leave us with? Yesterday, I made my own rice flour German chocolate birthday cake. It was quite edible. I know all the brands of cookies and cheese puffs, which actually taste a little too good, which are available at the co-op. I have finally discovered a rice-based pizza crust that even my kid and his buddies will eat, and you know 12-year-olds. After a series of notable culinary disasters, once a cake I made and tried to finish up in the microwave burst into flames, I managed to feed myself. I can now look at pie without slobbering and crying. It's kind of like being off cigarettes long enough so that you can watch someone else smoke. I did have a dream about eating a piece of toast recently and woke up with my notebook between my teeth. Nah, just kidding. Another warning. People think you're nuts when you tell them about this. I carry a restaurant card from the Celiac Sprue Association that very politely lists the gargantuan number of things I can't have on one side and the 7 things I can have, I exaggerate a little bit, on the other. I have frequently imagined the polite wait person carrying it carefully to the kitchen where the cook takes one look, tosses it aside, sprinkles breadcrumbs all over my steak, and joins the whole staff to watch what happens when I dig into it. Once I told a waiter I couldn't have grains, and being from the South, he repeated, "No grains? No lettuce?" I said, "Please bring me a baked potato and a glass of water." I was terrified to ask for the Cobb salad. He might have thought I said no futons instead of no croutons. More than once I have remained in my pew at church while others went forward to take the host on the tips of their tongues. What should I have done? Spat out the body of Christ into a hanky? It's so quiet up there. I couldn't quite explain or go up and kneeling read this essay, could I? For me, the staff of life is a cudgel. So when you offer up a toast to me on my birthday, make it a rice cake, okay? This is Gay Davidson-Zelsky, still dreaming of her mother's white gravy and sourdough biscuits for Mind's Gut Radio.
Poets have focused on food for generations, from Shakespeare's gluttonous Falstaff to Pablo Neruda's Remembrance. And so it is with Mind's Eye poets Lynn Patrick Smith and Fran Rawl, who offer the following for our larder.
Kalamata. Never mind California olives. Greeks are the ones. All wrinkled and bitter. Ambrosial. Food for the gods, and probably were. They conjure up visions. Women in kerchiefs gather the harvest from big sheets spread under 100-year trees. Some go to the crusher for oil. First-class virgin is best, of course. Now that's Greeks for you. Others are poured into pointy-ended amphoras, sitting in holds in the dirt floor, where they marry with mysterious spices. How long do they linger there, gathering savor? Now they enhance my tabbouleh, Turkish, spiced by a little Tex-Mex jalapeno juice. Hope that's all right, aficionados. It's as American as apple pie. This is Fran Rawl, recording for Mind's Eye Radio.
Easing into the morning with Van Morrison on the stereo. Imagine me and Cary Grant like silk blue pajamas, no robe. Holding a stoneware mug beneath an aromatic waterfall of coffee. Picture Janet with Hepburn hair, wearing my flannel shirt, preparing omelets. Delicate vegetables cooked with gorgeous sausage and luscious eggs. After breakfast, see us dance toward the living room. Ignore the dirty dishes. Think of music. Morning music, more music. This is Lynn Patrick Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
Now, lots of folks remember their mother's kitchen as a place of mouth-watering goodness, succulent odors, and sensual sounds, but that wasn't exactly the case for me. My mother's kitchen. Her broccoli is steamed to a rumor of food. This is cooking to cauterize appetite's wound. It's not her fault. She's a 50s mom. When kitchens are crucibles to incinerate E. coli and dirt, like the food's got to sign a loyalty oath not to taste like anything, especially earth. When mom's gone bowling and my sister cooks, she cooks the steak and not a protein hockey puck. But mostly my sister doesn't eat at home, or food. It's semi-sweet chocolate and cherry cokes away, at drugstores and places with dark wood booths. Mom's yelling about my sister's cigarettes, boyfriends, and beer again. My mom smokes Cools and always has a can of Blatz nearby. My sister stays away. It's noon. It's quiet in the kitchen, but for the heavy things. There's a drawer of them that squeals being opened and closed. The weight of common things, macrame placemats that can stop x-rays, and wicker coasters like manhole covers, and Playtex rubber gloves to anchor her concerto hands in yellow, green, and pink. Above the sink, tinned quinces, stacked sardines, cloudy jars of pig's feet and German beer steins dare the glass shelf break. The steins have metal lids that blink when the disposal's on, other times shut. Mom's Cools are the filter tips of her iceberg floating silent through her chores. She dumps the heavier garbage on a section of the Columbus Dispatch, and there is a fierce artistry here. She rolls from the corner, and it could be step one in the TV magician's trick. Pour a whole glass pitcher of milk down a newspaper cone. Or a Philip Guston stogie. She rolls and folds from the corner, folds back the pointed ends to cuffs, the envy of a Havana it holds. Such rolls are heavy with white jellied bacon grease, coffee grounds, and bones. Mom goes at the crud in the crack down the middle of the kitchen table next. A knife used to butter does the deed deep. The green chair she's in, a mint wafered green as the Girl Scouts at the door again, those girls again, interrupting dinner of grudging green beans in the throes again. After they go away, Mom will put on Prokofiev again, the huge black platters of her vinyl LPs, like another dish well done to toast. This is her tenderness, unfit to eat. This is Sustenance, or Food for Thought, on Mind's Eye Radio. Coming up in the next half of the show, we'll take a power lunch, journey into the world of fasting, and break the bread of our early years. I'm Greg Willard. We'll be back in a moment. Stick around, won't you? Mealtime is not just an opportunity to partake of good food. American business, for example, has turned the noon hour into a time for carefully orchestrated power lunches. But things don't always go as planned, as Evie Thompson demonstrates in her short story.
Today I have a lunch set up with some out-of-town corporate types. I'm hoping to woo them as clients. I do public relations, writing and editing on a freelance basis, and I really need this work right now. My late husband used to do the sales work for our business, but now it's up to me. This is my first time, and I have to admit I'm not looking forward to it. I'm wearing my black suit with the white blouse, trying to look very professional. I like it because the heavy fabric somewhat hides the lumps and bulges of my middle-aged figure. The restaurant they have chosen is fancy. White linen tablecloths, napkins folded in accordion fans and stuck in small bowls. The coat tree is overloaded, but I manage to hang my raincoat on it anyway, and I walk over to their table with what I hope is a confident smile. They rise, and we shake hands all round. They're younger than I thought they'd be, and well-dressed. The one named Don has on a custom-tailored dress shirt, the cuffs embroidered with his initials. We talk about the weather and the traffic. The menu has political names for the food. I choose the first possible option so I can concentrate on ingratiating myself. It's called Watergate Secret, and I have no idea what it is, but I order it anyway. I begin to munch on the breadsticks. The one named Mark says, "So, Anna, tell us about yourself." I struggle to swallow the bread. The salads arrive. The waiter says, "Pepper?" And I say, "No, thanks. I'm allergic to pepper." At my right, Don says, "Yes, please." And before I know it, I've sneezed all over the table. Across from me, the one named Craig now has a crumb of partially chewed bread stuck to the front of his blow-dried hair. The waiter mops at the table with a towel. "I'm so sorry," Craig says. "Quite all right. It could happen to anyone." But he doesn't know yet what's sticking in his hair. I can see the other two eyeing it and deciding not to say anything. The food arrives, and it turns out that my sandwich, the Watergate Secret, is a sloppy Joe, so it requires some concentration to get it in and out of my mouth without spilling over the sides. Meanwhile, Mark's hand is moving gracefully around his plate with deft strokes of the silverware like an Olympic skater. Nothing escapes the fork for even a second. I begin to tell them about myself, how I came into the business, what I've done to serve other clients like them. All this I've carefully rehearsed and re-rehearsed at home. And if it weren't for the bread particle clinging to Craig's hair, I'd feel things are going pretty well. Then I notice Craig glancing at my chest. I look down, and oh my, there is red sloppy Joe mix on my white blouse. The Watergate Secret has spilled out. Quickly, I brush it off with my napkin. I pull the right side of my suit jacket tightly across the stain, but it keeps slipping out. Don stares fixedly at his plate, and the others pick at their food. It seems they're done eating. Mark signals the waiter, who is instantly there with the checks. Craig says, "We appreciate your taking this time to talk with us." The bit of bread in his hair bounces as he nods his head. I'm being dismissed, so I grab my check and try to rise. The chair resists being pushed back. I discover I'm pushing it into a little gray-haired lady who is passing by between the tables. She scowls at me, and as I stand and turn and face her, she viciously shoves my chair at me, bruising my knees and knocking me off balance so that I sink back onto my plate on the table. And now I have bits of the Watergate Secret on my left hip. I wipe them off with the napkin. Craig, Don, and Mark stare, as if transfixed. I make my way to the cashier and give him my credit card. Runs are starting in both my stockings where the chair bumped me. I can feel the stitches letting go one by one. And yet, gradually, I feel some relief. Well, at least that's over. Unfortunately, when I pull my raincoat from that crowded coat tree, it catches on something, and the whole coat tree begins to rock. As I seize it in both arms to steady it, I see Craig, Don, and Mark half rise from their table and look over at me. Then the weight of the whole rack is upon me. I'm being smothered, and I wrestle with it hopelessly. I want to die. I take a deep breath, and that reminds me of my exercise class, the routine that goes breathe, plant, push. I've already breathed, and I notice that I've instinctively planted my feet and I'm bent at the knee. So I push. Little by little, I right the tree rack and steady it on its narrow base. Now the manager comes from behind the cash register. "Can I help you?" "No, I'm doing just fine." I pull on my coat, and I don't even glance over at Craig, Don, and Mark as I walk out the door. This is Evie Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
We know the value of taking sustenance, but what about the value of withholding sustenance? From Gandhi to Dick Gregory, people have used the power of fasting for mental clarity and social justice. Here's an excerpt from Radio Netherlands' EuroQuest series on fasting and starvation.
It's a way to purify yourself spiritually. So ultimately, it's a way of prayer.
Author and activist Reverend John Deere, a Jesuit priest.
Fasting makes one more conscious about one's spirituality as well as one's morality.
Devout Muslim Dr. M. Abdul Bari from the East London Mosque.
Every person that dies that I've looked after, I've reflected on their death in a major way and I've reviewed their treatment.
Professor Mike Golden, nutritionist from Aberdeen University. Fasting has had religious resonance for hundreds of years. It's a way of making all men equal. The one way that the rich can, for a time at least, feel the physical hunger of the poor. It's a recognized ritual in most of the world's religions, and because of its connections with spirituality, it has become an effective tool of political activism.
Fasting, for me, would be done for a variety of reasons. I see myself, first of all, as a Christian, as a follower of Jesus. I'm a Catholic priest also, and I look at the life story of Jesus. He began his public ministry for peace and justice with a 40-day fast in the desert. Sort of, if you will, poetically, I mean, expelling all the inner demons of violence and rejecting the temptations to success and power and violence even, and just opening himself up to the God of peace. It's a way to purify yourself spiritually. So ultimately, it's a way of prayer. There's a whole other way of fasting, which would be a public, political type of protest. Gandhi being the ultimate kind of fasting maniac.
The verse that makes fasting compulsory for the Muslims is in Surah Al-Baqarah, the second chapter of the Quran. In its 183rd verse, Allah tells, O you who believe, fasting is prescribed to you as it was prescribed to those before you, that you may learn God consciousness.
A short-term fast has no effect on the body. In fact, we have been designed and built to have fasts of 24, 48, 72 hours. Throughout the whole of evolution, when we were hunters and gatherers, our forebears would go out and kill an animal and eat it, and they mightn't kill another animal for another 3 or 4 days. So our system is geared to having short-term fasts like that, and the normal religious fasts of a few days have no physiological effects. In fact, we have evolved to find this type of fast a healthy thing.
Fasting isn't starvation. Fasting has a prescribed time limit from the dawn to the dusk. And even Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, has mentioned that breaking the fast should be as quickly as possible after the sunset. So if someone keeps on fasting even after the sunset, that will not be treated as a fast in Islam.
It was so hard not to eat. But then, what was so surprising to me was, I mean, my body, and what most people say, is that something kicks in, your whole system shuts down. You're like your plumbing system. And, wow, all the hunger and, you know, going off of coffee, all of that stopped. And I just felt really at peace, and I had a lot more energy because, you know, for the next 2 weeks, the body was living off of body fat and all. So I wasn't really hungry. I actually had a lot more energy. And then what I discovered was I was shocked about the amount of time that I spend in my life thinking about food. So much of life is about food.
What I personally experience when I fast that although I might feel a bit hungry, especially at the end of the day, but because I intended to fast, because I had the conviction of fasting, I don't feel that at all. I remember in the long summer days in Britain, when I was fasting, and I was in Air Force, and I still remember the difficult days in the training and other exercises, but I didn't feel that fasting made me weak. In fact, when fasting, I always think that a sort of love and affection from Allah is running through me, and that keeps me going on, and I feel more or less elevated during fasting. It intensifies my faith, and it brings me closer to the existence of God who has created me and all other creation.
It is well described by adults who have fasted, but their mental processes start slowing down. What happens with the slowing down of the mind is associated with the focusing of the thoughts. And these people describe how their mind becomes very focused, how mortality becomes very close, and they see death, and they see because of this the profundity of life and the majesty of life, and also the self-denial that they've had. It's like many religious practices, self-denial is something which is in lifting. And they go from a stage of being focused on food, the appetite goes, and when they reach this stage, their focused mind begins to think about the profundity of life. And I can well understand how this is a profound religious experience for many people.
Thanks go to Reverend John Deere, Jesuit priest, author and activist, Dr. M. Abdul Bari from the East London Mosque, and Professor Michael Golden, head of nutrition at Aberdeen University.
You're listening to Sustenance, or Food for Thought, on Mind's Eye Radio. I'm your host, Greg Willard. Coming up, we feast on the bread of our early years and search for food in Chicago. Stay with us. We use food as a metaphor for many facets of our lives. Poet Esther Cameron found a most appropriate analogy in a poem she composed for the opening ceremony of a conference on diversity in which people shared their ethnic breads.
The bread of our early years. Here, in the space we have built with our words, where my story is a stone and your story is a stone, in the temple of a common listening ear, where your voice has echoed and my voice has echoed, we sit down now and prepare to break bread. This is the bread of my early years, the dark rye, the roti, the tortilla, the pizza. This is the bread from my mother's kitchen, the pita, the matzah, the corn cake, the slice of white. This is the bread I ate with my laughter among kin. This is the bread I ate with my tears among strangers. I break it for you. Eat. And yours too I will taste. I will taste the tears you shed among strangers. I will taste your laughter among kin. I will smell the smells of your mother's kitchen. I will feel the hunger of your early years. In a vision I saw a great tree with wide-spreading branches, and beneath the tree were many circles of humans arranged in one great circle. At the center of every circle there was a fire on which they cooked their food, a fire that warmed them and cheered them at night, a fire to which they sang songs. And every now and then someone would go out from one circle and walk around the other circles with gifts of song and story and food, listening to their songs and stories and eating of their food. And all they ate was fruits of one tree, and all knew this. Therefore we bless, we ask a blessing, on all who share this food, on the earth that brought it forth, on all who labored that it might come to our mouths. May what is sacred to you be honored by me. May what is sacred to me be honored by you, and may this be sacred. I'm Esther Cameron for Mind's Eye Radio.
People ask me, why do you write about food and eating and drinking? Why don't you write about the struggle for power and security and about love the way others do? They ask it accusingly, as if I were somehow gross, unfaithful to the honor of my craft. The easiest answer is to say that, like most other humans, I am hungry. But there is more than that. It seems to me that our three basic needs for food and security and love are so mixed and mingled and entwined that we cannot straightly think of one without the others. So it happens that when I write of hunger, I'm really writing about love and the hunger for it, and warmth and the love of it, and hunger for it, and then the warmth and richness and fine reality of hunger satisfied. And it is all one. I tell about myself and how I ate bread on a lasting hillside, or drank red wine in a room now blown to bits, and it happens without my willing it that I am telling, too, about the people with me then, and their other, deeper needs for love and happiness. There is food in the bowl, and more often than not, because of what honestly I have, there is nourishment in the heart to feed the wilder, more insistent hungers. We must eat. If, in the face of that dread fact, we can find other nourishment and tolerance and compassion for it, we'll be no less full of human dignity. There is a communion of more than our bodies when bread is broken and wine drunk. And that is my answer when people ask me, why do you write about hunger, and why not wars or love? M.F.K. Fisher from The Gastronomical Me, published in 1943. Have you ever walked through a city in search of sustenance and been not quite sure what you're hungry for? Perhaps it wasn't your body that needed food, as Elena Tabachnik relates in her essay, A Chicago Feast.
A Chicago Feast, March 16th, 1998. I was hungry as I walked out of my office building onto Jackson. Traffic lights flashed hot cinnamon and cool mint against the dusk blue sky, and an elevated train grumbled as it pulled into its station. A bit bumpy, a bit slow, it spilled steam table light onto the tarred wood platform where commuters huddled in a mass of damp wrappings. A flock of Buddhist monks crossed Wabash under the L tracks, their robes the same pumpkin orange as the raincoat of the traffic cop. Wanting more, I walked past the L, the Art Institute, and Buckingham Fountain, past skyscrapers that leapt into the clouds and a sign that shouted, Congress Hotel! In neon's crimson glow. At Lakeshore Drive, demon traffic shrieked to a vanishing horizon point. Momentarily held by a light, they strained to crush me as I scuttled under their noses. On the other side, between traffic and the sky, Lake Michigan romped, licking and lapping at the cement shore. Capricious winds pushed the lake's surface into tiny Matterhorns of interference waves. Their infant peaks turned to thin skim milk by electric light from street lamps, a sipping aperitif. But deep in the brooding east, the lake was an indomitable silence, too dark and complicated for human consumption. So I turned, keeping my eyes close to the shore. At the water's edge, a small forest of weeds grew, where rumpled cement was held by corrugated iron sheets. Dry weeds last through winter wind, ice, and waves, waiting to be the food for another spring's growth. Also waiting, beach cement moorings for summer boats, squatted shoulder to shoulder. Bits of broken chain and old rope were twisted in their rusted iron loops. Nearby, whole barrels of chain lay heavy under a delicate crust of lake scum, zebra mussels, and dry algae. Some of the moorings were tires filled with cement. They held water and floating ring ice. I cracked the ice and lifted a piece. It was crescent-shaped, with a pointed animal snout. A spray of trapped bubbles danced against the rougher air side, but a thin flange that had lain in the water was as smooth and slippery as frozen jello. It was the dusk made solid. I searched for a small piece of chain and found half a broken link. Holding these, I wanted to eat all the earth, the trees, the sky, and the water. I stood with eyes and mouth wide, drinking great gulps of dusk. But no matter how much I swallowed, I was still hungry. After all, I am only a small body, and it was a looming great sky. This is Elena Tabachnik for Mind's Eye Radio.
That's our show. Thanks for listening to Sustenance, or Food for Thought, from the Mind's Eye Radio Collective of Madison, Wisconsin. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Dick Radke and Sue Renard. Contributing writers include Esther Cameron, Gay Davidson-Zielski, Ken Haynes, Dick Radke, Fran Rawl, Sue Renard, Lynn Patrick Smith, Elena Tabachnik, Evie Thompson, Kelly Warren, and Greg Willard. Original music by Barbara Chusid. Thanks to Bon Appetit Cafe in Madison for letting us use their kitchen. If you'd like a copy of this show, or would like more information about Mind's Eye Radio, see our website at www.mindseyeaudio.com. I'm your host, Greg Willard. We hope we've given you some food for thought. Oh, and just remember, you are what you eat. And that includes concentrated fruit juices, pineapple, peach, pear, natural flavors, non-fat dry milk, pressed canola oil, vegetable glycerin, soy protein, cocoa powder, soy lecithin, wheat gluten, baking soda, cream of tartar, carrageenan. How do you say that? Pyrophosphate and reduced iron.